So I am wanted to share with you a little bit, some Dharma offerings. I hope it's helpful, about equanimity and this theme that Marnie and I kind of were talking about, the deep keel of equanimity, perhaps appropriate for people living on islands who need boats to get there. And I grew up on Long Island Sound with boats, So, you know, it's kind of a paradox of the path of insight that just as we realize everything is impermanent and interdependent and constantly changing, that's where we find stability. And this realization of that, of the stability, is equanimity, of this deep keel of stability in the middle of change. Is equanimity. And that's a friend in life. You know, that brings us peace of mind, no matter the situation. And no secret that 2020 was a challenging year, and without getting political, because we don't want to, but nonetheless, political difficulties, racial strife, partisan politics, a global pandemic, accelerating climate change, pretty gnarly. And safe to say, roller coaster ride's not over just because it never is, for one thing. So, you know, if you're relaxing and taking off your seatbelt, probably should buckle up again. But let's see how we can inwardly buckle up to navigate better. Not that we didn't navigate well, but let's, you know, go deeper. Because we're probably going to get battered by opposing views in traumatic situations. It's going to happen. And we need to find our stability inside. Equanimity is so amazing. Part of the, as many of you know, probably all of you know, the four Brahma Viharas. Metta, Karuna, which is compassion. Metta is loving kindness. And Mudita, which is rejoicing in the joy of others. But equanimity is the last and the subtlest of the four. Upekkha in Pali has to do with a balanced and calm response to inner and outer arisings. And on a conventional level, just like a conventional and ultimate level of, well, everything. And on a conventional level, equanimity suggests kind of emotional steadiness, calmness of heart and mind, something we, a lot of us, develop as people, having to do with emotional stability and good intentions. And we know lots of people who are not Buddhist, whatever, that have a lot of stability and equanimity in that way. You can depend on them. That's great. You can depend on them in a difficult time. But there's a more profound layer of equanimity, the ultimate level, that gets to the heart of awakening, what this practice is about, to the wisdom that arises. And because this stability of equanimity is so subtle, one way to approach it is to understand what it is not. In particular, we're not talking about indifference or aloofness or complacency, all of which are pulling back from life. In fact, indifference is often called the near enemy of equanimity. This means that while equanimity and indifference may resemble each other, equanimity is not indifferent at all. Equanimity is, you might say, among other things, a protection from what's called the world, eight worldly dharmas. You've probably heard of them: praise and blame, success and failure, pleasure and pain, fame and disrepute. It's a way to navigate through those without being batted around by them. Because being, you know, attached to or elated by success, praise, fame, or pleasure is a setup for suffering when the winds of change shift. To have our well-being dependent on anything like that is a setup for failure, not equanimity at all. But if we realize that our well-being is independent of all those outer forces, then we're more apt to be able to keep an even keel despite what happens. But we don't keep this even keel of equanimity by forcing anything. And that's, you know, how the Dharma works. We're not trying to clench our teeth to stay stable, because that's just like, that's fragile. Any teeth clenching, the more we have to see through the illusions that would otherwise mislead us. Gil Fronsdal, great Western teacher, Gil Fronsdal, says, trying to fit into some idealistic model of what being equanimous is supposed to look like can all too easily produce such threats to equanimity as indifference, aloofness, rigidity, or complacency. But when the obstacles are understood and removed, then the resulting equanimity can be the foundation for caring, presence, flexibility, and diligence. And I love the word flexibility there, because that is what this is flexibility. That's what equanimity is. And as I was saying, it's associated with wisdom, with the awakening that this path takes us toward. It kind of illuminates. When we turn toward equanimity, it illuminates our mistaken sense of self and how we get all stuck around that. So equanimity, it's like the other Brahma Viharas, there's an aspect of it that we can cultivate. We can sort of cultivate and practice some sense of equanimity, but in this particular one, it more emerges out of our practice. It just emerges and presents itself to us. The word upekkha, it means to look over, and refers to equanimity arising from the power of mindfulness, the ability to see without being caught by what we see. So looking over is like seeing, but without being caught by what we see. And doesn't that kind of capture the dilemma, our dilemma here in the 21st century? I mean, this is an interesting time, kind of unique. Because when we think of great practitioners in centuries past, they were kind of separate from global information and kind of separated from those in power in ways that's hard to imagine now. For most of us, you know, the world's gotten so much smaller. There's big global issues like climate change that can't ignore. Digitally, we're all interconnected. So we need to do our work about equanimity in the middle of all that if we want to show up, which I think all of us do. So to be sure, the Buddha, we might think he lived in this sort of cosmic lovely bubble where it was just easy and orchids falling down off trees and things, but actually there was political power struggles and war in his own life. Towards the end of his life, the very sutta, the very long sutta in the Digha Nikaya that talks about the last years of his life, the Kosala king, Biddhadabha, I think I said that right, launched a war against the Sakya capital, and the Buddha had to leave, went to Rajagir in Magadha, seeking the protection of King Ajatasattu, who ironically was the king who had deposed his father, Bimbisara, who'd been one of the and killed his father, who had been one of the original supporters of the Buddha. So it was difficult. And then while he was there, he tried to talk the king, Ajatasattu, if I say that wrong, out of invading the Vajjayans, another kingdom nearby. He talked to his minister. But he told them how they had seven ethical qualities and you shouldn't invade them, but he did anyway. So point being that no matter how gnarly it has seemed in this last year, we didn't actually have a war. We didn't actually have to flee where we were because there was a war. And we didn't in a position of trying to stop someone from perpetrating a war, which they actually did. And it's fascinating that having said all that, some of the Buddha's deepest teachings are right in that period also. So he had this equanimity where he could navigate these difficulties and still be fully engaged with the Dharma, which is a capacity all of us have. And this interweaving of difficulty and the full wisdom is interwoven all through the suttas. You know, a lot of you know, is speaking of family problems, has cousin Devadatta and multiple, trying to kill him multiple times. I don't think any of us have had that particular situation in our families. So it's a real dynamic in the suttas, and it shows how the equanimity that the Buddha evidenced was, tempered in the reality of samsaric life. But in a way, that's a beautiful thing, because it's a doorway for us in terms of what we can do. We don't have to think, oh gosh, that was a perfect time. This is 21st century and it's terrible. Nope, here we are. Same kind of deal, in some ways easier now. So what's interesting about reading the suttas and how the Buddha's attitude was, is we don't hear any judgment about the kings who wanted to invade or who started wars. He just has a steady and compassionate voice for peace. And sometimes there's been a few where he gives this teaching, this deep, deep teaching to this king who somehow had a capacity to hear, or he wouldn't have given such a deep teaching. You can see in the suttas, he gets pulled out by who he talks to. And someone who has that capacity ends up saying these amazing things. And then at the end is this one king says, well, basically, thank you. That was really amazing. I'm very busy. I got to go. And the Buddha says, as you will, king. And so, but he keeps recognizing a possibility. He doesn't judge. He doesn't get stuck in dichotomies. He just focuses on what's possible in each being and has this stability in himself. So you could say that he was looking over these difficult situations with equanimity because of this steady love and compassion he kept expressing. Dalai Lama, you know, here in the 20th century, 21st century, has faced a similarly impossible situation in most of his lifetime, trying to stop or at least curb the Chinese destruction of Tibetan sovereignty and culture and religion. And, you know, damage continues. And no one would fault him if he got a little bitter or a little angry, but he doesn't. He just doesn't. He has this regard for the Tibetan people, and he has this compassion for, you might say, the perpetrators in terms of the karma and the states of mind that they're cultivating for themselves. This amazing depth of equanimity and joy in the middle of fully feeling the pain of that. It's often noted how he can move back and forth between those qualities with this fluidity, as kind of this flexibility, kind of what Gil was talking about. Dalai Lama wrote, by developing equanimity, you seek to stop using the fact that someone is harming you or your friends as a reason for being hostile to that person. Instead, you should take this same fact and use it as a reason for practicing patience toward that person. After all, an enemy is a supreme opportunity for generating the important practice of compassionate forbearance, and thus is as valuable as a spiritual guide. So that's something we can all think about, because, you know, over the last year, without getting political at all, but I'm sure some of us had strong feelings about certain leaders. And it's easy to concretize around that, to think of them as a problem, to forget their potential for awakening. And to, oops, cat just unplugged me. To forget their potential for awakening and to turn them into objects, which turns us into objects, which then catches us on the fangs of dichotomy, and equanimity is gone. So as he says, it's repeatedly, especially in Mahayana world, that the most difficult person is your greatest teacher. And you can see in him, the Dalai Lama, he sees the potential of any person that comes before him. You know, we all kind of divide and have hierarchies and people we think are cool and people we think aren't, and people want to be friends with, even if we're sitting in an auditorium with 2,000 people. Yep, gratitude for my enemy. Yep, someone is Gene. Thank you, Gina. But he sees right through that. And so it really, like, is, I think, indicates the possibility of how we can be And that's what moves us towards equanimity, this open-hearted stability. And this gradually emerges through our mindfulness practice as we become more mindfully aware of the constant change of impermanence. You know, it just becomes more and more clear there's nothing permanent to depend on. So in turn, it becomes clear there's nothing to be disappointed by. We couldn't depend on it in the first place. What's the problem? There's nothing to be disappointed by. And we start to see through clinging. We start to see there's no need to right the boat. We don't need it to be upright. We don't need it to hold it upright. Because when we're balanced and internally harmonious and not resisting, no matter how difficult are the seas of positive and negativity around us, the boat rights itself because of that deep keel. Just to tell a little story about myself. This time last year, I was facing death in a kind of immediate and visceral way. I have a heart condition. And at that point, I didn't know it yet. I was 98% blocked of my left anterior descending artery. And that's among cardiologists and their amusing black humor. They call it the widowmaker, that particular artery, because if it gets blocked, you're gone. And instantaneously. So what I did know was at that point, I could hardly walk up the block because of angina would just really hurt. I mean, I just couldn't do it. And I couldn't do much of anything without nitroglycerin. And the odd thing was, I really wasn't tormented or gloomy or worried or anything other than a sense, I think Harold and I discussed this a little bit, of wanting to power up my practice because I was aware that time was short. I mean, I was working with a cardiologist and it was sort of this incremental process we were going through. But it was interesting. It was interesting. And I realized that I'm not claiming anything special about myself, but I mean, it's not about me, but there was some degree of equanimity just because of a lot of practice that sort of permeated my bones with a sense that gain and loss in life wasn't that personally gripping anymore. As myself had kind of thinned a little bit, and it was interesting. So it kind of, my wife and I kind of got a sense of humor about this, and we'd go for walks and we'd be going up this tiny little incline near the house. And sometimes I'd stop and say, oh, look at the bark of that tree. That's so cool. Which was code for, I cannot walk another foot. And we both stop and look at the bark until the angina calmed down. Then go on. It was okay. And finally figured it out. I now have two stents, and through the magic of modern science, I'm pretty much my normal self again for the moment. But I think I learned something from that, you know, about equanimity, about just going deeper, about not getting stuck on what works and what doesn't, and just rocking back into being present. Gil says, again, one of the primary insights is the nature of impermanence. In the deepest forms of insight, we see that things change so quickly that we can't hold on to anything. And eventually, the mind lets go of clinging. Letting go brings equanimity. The greater the letting go, the deeper the equanimity. So it really shows you how this is a continuous process of our mindfulness. And, you know, as we've been talking about, the peculiar thing about our practices, for any one of us, wherever our particular sticking points are, that's what emerges. And we got a deal. It's like mindfulness self-selects the places where we're stuck, because that's what we haven't yet freed ourselves from. That's what hasn't freed itself through the process of being, through the process of awareness. So we sort of, our process of practice is self-sorting what is next. And then we get to show up. And then we get to be aware. And then eventually, as you said, the mind lets go of clinging. And letting go brings equanimity. And the greater the letting go, the deeper the equanimity. So there's a journey ahead, which is joyful. Joyful because equanimity brings freedom and there's no problem. And it kind of creeps up on us, on cat feet. I think that's one of the things that has charms me about practice is people grow and they don't realize they're growing sometimes. You know, they kind of go, oh man, my practice just kind of stuck, but I keep at it. And they're growing right there. And you can see them change sometimes. It's like, oh dude, you are getting so much more relaxed and present, but they actually didn't actually see it themselves because it seems kind of normal now. So it kind of creeps up on us and cat feet, and we hardly even know it's happening sometimes. And that's what's so beautiful. And often it's we're digging deep just when it seems like we're getting nowhere. So, you know, don't give up. As many teachers say, don't give up. And that's one of the subtleties of practice, you know, is that as we become more aware, we become more aware of discern things that seem like dichotomies or places to get stuck, and we show up and then we start to see through them. And we're seeing through things that a more oblivious person would not even notice. The subtleties that many of us, the nuances that many of us are working on, because I know there's a pretty experienced group here, which is so cool. So many people would not even notice. So you're going much deeper toward equanimity than we may realize. Story I wanted to share about the staying present in the midst of difficulty. Ajahn Chah, you know, the great Thai master Ajahn Chah, is his wonderful book, Stillness Flowing, which I totally recommend if you haven't read it. His incredible biography, Stillness Flowing, talks about his encounter with a tiger, because he did a long period of just being a wandering solitary monk back in an era when Thailand had extensive wild forests, and he was all alone way up in northern Thailand, sitting under a tree in the middle of the night as a solitary monk on his meditation mat, and they have an umbrella with a mosquito net that hangs around it. That was it. There's a word for it, I can't remember. And a tiger appeared, or was there in the dark, not very far away. And he felt terror. He said, as it got closer and closer, this isn't a second person, third person. As it got closer and closer, Lung Poor, that's what he was called there, could hear the sound of its breathing. He smelled on the wind the unmistakably rank odor that meant the tiger was approaching. He tried to lie as still as a rock, but one part of his mind panicked and he started to shake uncontrollably. Fear was short-lived, however. He admonished himself. He said, forget about this life. Even if the tiger doesn't kill you, you're still going to die anyway. Dying while following the footsteps of the Buddha means something. If you've never killed and eaten the tiger in the past, then it won't hurt you. If you have, let it eat you and settle the debt. So he just kind of rolled into it, you know, just rolled into it and was present with it. And he, as it says, he recollected the virtues of the Buddha Dharma and the Sangha and his own Sila as his refuge. Meanwhile, the tiger had stopped. It was motionless behind him in the night. Lung Poor could hear it breathing about 4 or 5 meters away. He felt the tension of waiting for the quickening of that breath and the sudden lunge from behind him that would mean the end of his life. But now the thoughts and fears were somehow outside of his mind. The tiger did not move. A few moments later, Lung Poor heard it turn around and slowly return into the depths of the forest. The sound of crackling leaves gradually faded. And, you know, ironically, had he reacted and panicked and jumped up, probably the tiger would have eaten him. But he didn't. He just settled into his practice. He settled into his mindfulness. He found equanimity in the middle of that very overt threat and survived. But partly because he let go of whether he was going to survive or not. And then he did. So we can think that way, you know, because sometimes things just seem like impossibly difficult. I know that seemed like way to people in the last year, and people between COVID and everything. It's just been like just too much. But then the next moment shows up and the next one and the next one. And even if it's too much, you know, we just keep breathing and just keep staying present. and has a potential just to be there. So that whole key to equanimity in the middle of difficult circumstance is just to take things as they are, to be mindfully aware to the whole range life has to offer. And we learn to relax in full acceptance, full seeing of whatever is happening. And that's what keeps us upright. So it's worth affirming, you know, that this road to equanimity is often built from these bricks of gritty mindfulness, just where it's hard, just where we come up against really creepy stuff in ourselves or pain or difficulty. We have to find mindfulness to those places to have them drop away or to be able to be present with them without them grabbing us. This is a place where the four foundations of mindfulness, body, sensations or vedanas, pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, mind and mind objects, those four are really useful to kind of see them as a framework of how our practice goes. We don't have the time to go into all of them, but it's very useful. And for instance, suppose we're experiencing a strong set of emotions about a difficult politician or a chronic disease, and we're flooded and suffering. Through mindfulness practice, we can become aware, sort of suggesting a way to navigate these difficulties, become aware of the parts of this flood and let it untangle. Because the flood, when we're flooded, it seems like it's this big, sticky mass. And it probably almost seems like it's just too much. It's like, oh, it's just too much. But the more we can be practiced and let it untangle and come apart, then it becomes more and more manageable. You know, in that moment of flooding about COVID, perhaps, fear of COVID maybe or something, we might feel pain in our gut, like literally pain in our gut. But if we can rest with that mindfully, the pain in our gut might start to, it can, it starts to come apart a little bit, and it's tingling here and stretching there and burning here. And it becomes not this giant thing, but a series of sensations. And we start to see the thoughts that are going around and around and around. Same thoughts over and over of fear or projection or possibility. And we can see where they come from and why they have so much traction with us. And it becomes manageable. Just like a Chancha sitting with a tiger. He couldn't make the tiger go away, but he was able to make it manageable. And in this case, likely, that's why he survived. So we start to realize their impermanence, all of these emerging factors, we start to realize their impermanence and the fact that they have causes and conditions. They're dependently arising. They came from somewhere. They're not inherent anywhere. And it takes the teeth out of it. We realize they're not inherently us. We're sitting there suffering and all this stuff, but the more it comes apart, we start to realize there's not this I that's like in the center of this universe of suffering. It's just a bunch of factors flowing, and we can manage through it. And the identification with I gets looser and thinner, and it's manageable. And that's probably for the Buddha, it was manageable. In the midst of his great awakening was kind of how it was. I mean, having your cousin trying to kill you, that's the best it can be, is manageable, even if you may be fully awakened. But it never got good. So, you know, this is partly an encouragement, I guess, an encouragement, because sometimes, and I'm sort of repeating a little bit, but sort of to emphasize, I suppose, sometimes the very places that make us seem like it's just too much, we ought to give up, my practice sucks, are in fact the very places that are our doorways. And they're the places to show up. As much as that's a pain in the ass, they're the places to show up. And if we do, they'll open eventually. And even though we may have the idea that our meditation practice has to be this peaceful, calm thing, and sometimes it can be, sometimes it will be, sometimes our minds will center and there'll be this beautiful lucidity where moment by moment mindfulness will be seen that way. Other times it's in the middle of difficulty and boisterousness. And that's just where it is. And that's okay too. And so part of the art is to know how to navigate through all that and have confidence that it's actually working and taking us toward equanimity. Because that's why it's a keel in the middle of difficult times. Because we feel difficult times inwardly and outwardly. And because we have empathy, if other people are suffering, we feel that. And if there's injustice towards people of certain races, we feel that. And, you know, then we show up. So the tool for this investigation, I'm just going to introduce it again because we don't have that much time, called RAIN. I'm sure some of you are aware of it. R-A-I-N, very useful tool. Stands for recognize, is R, allow, is A, investigate is I, and non-identification is N. You can look it up on the web. It's a very useful way to navigate difficulties when it feels like they're raining on us, when it feels like it's just too much, and to really just settle into those places and recognize what's happening and allow it to happen. What choice do we have? To investigate it doesn't mean figure it out. It means be mindful of it and let it break into its component parts. Let it reveal itself for what it is, which is only what it is. And non-identification, once we see those component parts, we just let them be themselves. We're not, it's not me. It's not you. Just parts. So it can be real handy. It's so, especially for us in the Northwest, kind of get reminded of that a lot. The word RAIN, easy to remember. And it can be a good tool, you know, on this journey to equanimity. So as we cultivate mindfulness, you know, in each moment, kind of we gradually dismantle this sense that is anything worth grasping. And we gradually dismantle this sense there's anybody to do the grasping. Both those things slowly come apart. And that, as Gil was suggesting, brings us to equanimity, no matter what the conditions. And it's from this even keel of equanimity that some of the greatest moral leaders of our age have done their most important work. Because it's important to know that this doesn't mean, like I said in the beginning, indifference. It's not that near enemy that looks like it but isn't. This is not about indifference. This is about showing up. So Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King, Dalai Lama, Nelson Mandela, all of them, they looked over the negativity and sometimes hatred directed toward them. They gave back love with this relentless steadiness of equanimity. That's what's so amazing about what they did. And it's actually, in fact, the only way they did what they did. Nelson Mandela, in prison for 20 years in South Africa, he did not demonize his imprisoners. He did not demonize those who created apartheid. He understood them as human beings who were expressing that racism. But it came from somewhere. It came from fear, came from cultural momentum, whatever. He treated them as people and continually did that. And that's part of how he was able to be effective. So this isn't about this, you know, equanimity is not about distancing ourselves or anything, just about being fully aware and conscious and showing up. And as we free ourselves from grasping and aversion. The Burmese teacher Upandita says, equanimity is not insensitivity, indifference, or apathy. It is simply non-preferential. Under its influence, one does not push aside the things one dislikes or grasp at the things one prefers. The mind rests in an attitude of balance and acceptance of things as they are. So, you know, this is a full embracing of life. We're turning toward life in this practice. And then we can engage with good hearts, whoever we're called to do, but with a kind of a recognition of all the human beings we encounter, whatever roles and positions they take, with a good heart toward them all. Because we don't know what's going to happen in 2021. virus could kick loose. Cascadia subduction zone could kick loose. We just do not know. So, you know, to breathe a sigh of relief and say, "Oof, boy, I'm glad that," and just sort of let flop ourselves back into depending on external conditions probably is not a good plan. You know, we should always go deeper and take this opportunity. Okay, I think that's about what I got to share. Thank you very much.